Tickets are now available for I Am The Egg Pod Live, taking place at 3 p.m. on Saturday the 1st of July at the beautiful Opera Holland Park in London. If you love the Beatles, then this is for you. There'll be an afternoon of Beatles discussions, exploring their music, their impact on popular culture, and the stories behind these legendary songs. Plus, an ideal opportunity to meet fellow Egg Podders and Beatle fans. In part one, Samira Ahmed, Stuart McConey, and David Quantick, and they'll be sharing their thoughts and insight into the Beatles' music. Then, in part two, Mark Lewison, world-renowned Beatles historian and author of the definitive Beatles biography, Tune In, and he's going to share his unrivaled expertise on the Fab Four story. So if you want to join in the fun, then tickets are available by going to iamtheeggpod.com. Saturday, 1st of July, 2023, starting 3 p.m. at Opera Holland Park Theatre, London. Hopefully see you there. Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a joy to welcome Jenny Boyd. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Chris.
I'm loving your book, which is just coming out on paperback, Jennifer Juniper, Journey Beyond the Muse. I'm guessing reading it, it must have been quite a cathartic process for you.
It really was. And it took me quite a number of years, because originally I didn't know I was actually going to be writing a book. I was just jotting down memories when I got back to England after living in LA for many years. And it seemed like the end of one era and the beginning of another. And I just kept writing and writing. And at one point, I wasn't sure if I was actually going to do a memoir or whether I was going to do a fiction, and a thinly disguised fiction. But then I decided, oh, I'll go for it. I'll do the memoir.
Let's start very briefly, but you grew up in Africa, one of four siblings at the time, is that right?
Yes. I was born in England, and my older sister, Patty, and then I had a brother. And then when I was just a few months old, my mother and father went to Africa, because at that time, the government were offering grants for people to farm the land. And so my basic memories are of being in Africa. And we were quite feral, just kind of roaming around, never wearing shoes. And I was there until I was six, then came back here to England.
So was that must have been a culture shock coming to the UK?
It was, because, you know, we saw things like what we call double-decker buses. And we saw snow. And, you know, it was very different. And also, my mother had remarried when she was in Africa, and they'd left for England with our younger sister. And then I didn't get back to England until I flew over by myself about 6 months later. So, you know, I hadn't seen my mother. By that time, she was pregnant. And so it was a culture shock in many ways.
So schooling, what was that like?
Well, the funny thing is that I was christened Helen, although I've always been called Jenny all my life, because Patty had a doll or dog or something fluffy that was obviously looking a bit grubby, and my mother wanted to throw it away. And she said, only if one condition, that you call the next child, next daughter, Jenny. But I think she'd had an argument with an old aunt called Helen. So she christened me Helen, and I was just always called Jenny. So when I came to England and went to school for the first time, they were all calling me Helen. And I, to begin with, I didn't know who they were talking to.
Who is this? Yeah, so I mean, we'll move on a bit now. But obviously, the modelling career for you and Patty, how did that come about?
I was at school. I was at Holland Park School in Notting Hill Gate. I'd been to a convent school before that. So that was quite a culture shock.
Yeah,
then came to, we moved to London, and I went to Holland Park. And we used to, when I was about 16, after school, go to the coffee shop in Holland Park, in Notting Hill Gate. And Mick had obviously seen me there, because he was living nearby and he was in this band called The Shanes. And he told me later that when he saw me, he decided that was the girl he was going to marry. And but anyway, I had a sort of boyfriend at the time. And through him, he introduced me to two fashion designers, Fole and Tuffin, and said he'd said to them, "Oh, you know, my girlfriend, she's probably will do all right," because they were looking for a house model. And I thought I was going to continue at school, but I got the job and was told to start the following Monday. And I never told my mother. She didn't really notice. So
really?
So that's how I got to become a fashion. It was really a house model. I would just show editors from sort of Vogue and all the sort of glossy magazines, and then gradually they wanted to use me sort of in photographic, do sort of more photography, and so then I became a photographic model. I never thought I was going to be a model. I mean, I didn't have it in mind at all.
Well, you were saying in your book you were quite shy when you were younger, so it's quite a big thing to sort of stand and or dance and say, "Here I am," in front of a load of photographers.
Well, actually, dancing was the best, because I could have danced on a tabletop. You know, I loved dancing. I loved music, especially when all the Motown came in. And that was one of my favourite things. But, you know, most of the photographers were young and it was fun and it was all very much part of the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, my reference point is going to be things like Alfie. Was it kind of like that?
Sort of.
Okay.
No, it was great. And then, you know, we were, when I was working as a house model, then we all went to New York and they wanted Patty to come too. And they had two Mary Quant models. And, you know, it was quite an experience. And I was still 16, probably just 17.
Wow.
It was like being thrown in the deep end.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright.
Around this time, obviously, your older sister Patty got a role in A Hard Day's Night. Can you remember when she told you that?
Yeah, I remember her telling our mother. She called her, because she'd left home by then. We could hear our mother sort of shrieking with excitement. and then she said, you know, she told us all. And the funniest thing, actually, I didn't put this in the book. I used to have this little hamster that I was very fond of, and I would let it out, you know, when we were in the sitting room, so it could wander around. And our younger sister, Paula, was so excited when she heard the news that she jumped up off the sofa and trod on the little hamster. Oh, I know, it was terrible.
Oh, look.
And I thought the hamster was going to survive, you know, so it went in its little cage, obviously really in shock. And the next day when I came back from school, there was another hamster in its place, a great big fat thing. And they obviously thought, oh, she won't notice,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. Can you remember its name?
No, isn't that terrible? Oh, I can't.
You've obviously buried it.
I must
literally
have.
And metaphorically. So, yeah, and you told stories, obviously, your first impressions of George, and he was invited over Sunday roast.
Yes, yes. And our mother thought she was being very cool. There was a wonderful song by a singer called Millie called My Boy Lollipop.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so she put that on blasting through the house to sort of welcome George. And I'd already met him, so, you know, I felt perfectly comfortable with him. And it was like, he was so easy to be with. It was like just being with your sister's new boyfriend.
Yeah, because you were saying at the time you're more into the sixth-born boys at the time.
Yeah, exactly, crushes. So it was lovely, it was very sweet. And he showed me the chords to a Buddy Holly song that I was a huge Buddy Holly fan. And I'd been given the guitar, but nobody ever suggested lessons. So he was showing me what chords to, you know, all you needed for Peggy Sue. And then he noticed that I was squinting. He said, well, you should try some contact lenses. You know, John's got a pair, and he was blind as a bat.
Yeah.
So he was just very sweet and very, very welcoming.
So obviously, as they got bigger, I'm guessing you saw less of Patty. Although you did, I mean, when they were on tour, you and Patty would go around George and Ringo's place.
Yes. Yeah, and I was still at school, and They had a flat that they'd rented in Knightsbridge, and they were on tour. So I'd come and visit Patty after school, and we'd smoke Stuyvesant cigarettes and some Scotch and Coke. and I remember meeting Jane Asher, who was there at one point, and then Patty and I went to Ready Steady Go, and there was Kathy McGowan. She was the one who was hosting it. So it was fun. I did see a lot of Patty.
Yeah. This time, obviously, you're with Mick Fleetwood, in case everybody doesn't know, I think everybody does. Mm-hmm. But I love that you were saying about the camaraderie with places like the Ad Lib or Scotch at St. James, where you'd see everybody there. And it was, I think the Beatles had their own table, didn't they? And the Stones had their own table.
Well, I don't remember them having their own table, but I do remember, you know, there would be either, you know, Brian Jones or, you know, all these different musicians. And it was definitely a place where everybody felt relaxed with each other. And you all knew that, you know, you were all cool, and it was nobody was going to go up and ask for autographs, because it just wasn't like that.
Yeah.
And it was all the best, as I said, like Motown music, music that you couldn't actually get because it was from America, and only those bands who'd actually gone on tour could come back with those 45s.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And in your book, you were saying, so I'm guessing at this time, so you're still modelling, but you mentioned a book by Christmas Humphreys called Karma and Rebirth, and that seems to have had quite a big impact.
Yes, well, yeah, we'd started smoking pot, and I had, you know, friends, and we were in Chelsea, and there was one friend of ours who lived on, I think it was Blantyre Street, and we would always go there, and everyone would sort of smoke pot and just sit and listen to music. No, hardly anybody spoke. So there was one point where I saw some, he was obviously a bit of a seeker, and I picked up one of these books around the coffee table, and I just came across this passage that said, life goes on within you and without you. And I was so taken by that that I immediately called Patty and George, and George answered, and I said, you know, listen to this, life goes on within you and without you. And obviously we know what happened then. And so, you know, it inspired him to write a song.
Yeah, so this seems to be prevalent, not just with yourself and the Beatles, but so many people were starting to get into the idea of karma and this kind of thing. It's something in the air.
Yeah, there was definitely a change. You know, it wasn't all the fun Dolly Bird sort of attitude anymore. I think everybody was looking for a deeper meaning. And I think because, you know, the people that we knew in our circle were smoking pot, and it kind of did make you more reflective, I think. And, you know, some people just laugh their heads off the whole time. But, you know, otherwise you would just be thinking. And I know for me, I had what I called like a sort of spiritual awakening. And I was just sitting by myself, and suddenly everything just kind of went into a zone. And I remember from then on, I didn't want to be a model anymore. You know, I just wanted to, I felt I was on a search.
Yeah.
But I didn't quite know what I was searching for, but I knew there was something other than just the mundane. And it was more than just, you know, we'd been brought up, you know, had to go to church with our mother and stepfather. So it was more than just God's above and hell's below. So it was definitely a sort of more reawakening. If you're going to San Francisco,
because you moved to San Francisco, which is, you know, if you're going to go anywhere for that kind of thing.
I know.
That was the perfect time.
But it wasn't, but nobody knew anything was going on in San Francisco. And it just so happened that a friend of mine who'd been in London, she was American, she was opening up a shop, and she asked if I would come and help her with the shop. And so I thought, okay, I'll try it. So I had enough money for 3 months' rent or a one-way ticket to San Francisco.
Oh, it was one way. Wow.
One way. And when I got there, I was amazed. It was like all this stuff that was going on, this counterculture. And it was everything that I'd kind of felt when I had what I'd called my sort of spiritual, you know, awakening. They all were sort of like that. And the music, everything was, it felt very connected, everybody.
Yeah. And you were at Monterey.
Yep. Yeah. That was the first pop festival, wasn't it?
Yeah.
My memories are Jimi Hendrix, you know, Mamas and the Papas, and people wandering around and giving flowers, and, you know, lots of little stalls selling paraphernalia. It was lovely.
Is that where you first saw Ravi Shankar?
It was, and it was extraordinary because it was raining that day. And as soon as he came on, the rain stopped and you could hear a pin drop, you know.
Wow.
And it was very special.
Because later on, well, you kept trying to get Patty and George to come over, didn't you? And it was, by the time they got there, things were slightly different.
It was awful, yeah, when they came over. It was in August. And they came with, I think Mal was there. You know, they came with Magic Alex and Neil. And, of course, we all had to go to the... Who did we go to? Warner Brothers or somewhere, and someone has a little bit of acid. So they thought, oh, that's what they need to kind of get the vibe. So we were all high as kites walking along Haight Ashbury that I'd been writing to them for the last sort of 4 or 5 months saying you must come. And gradually people, because the people that were there, they weren't all the sort of original hippies. They were all the people that had been told to turn on, tune in and drop out. And so it was very different how I imagined it would be. And the longer we walked along Haight Ashbury and the limo wouldn't come down, they were sort of waited right at the back. They didn't come as you drive down Haight Ashbury. And there was one point where we got to the panhandle and George sat down and all these kind of masses of people all sat down and someone bought a guitar and said, you know, play us a tune, play us some chords or, you know, whatever they were saying. So George got the guitar and just said, C, G, A. And it was, I was sort of way at the back and I thought, ooh, I don't think this is going to go down well.
Yeah.
And it didn't. So then we all got out and started to walk, tried to walk back very sort of sedately back to the limo. But by then they were sort of getting angry and they wanted to lay something on George and he wasn't the sort of hero that they thought he should be.
Yeah.
So we got, you know, our steps got quicker and quicker the closer we got to the limo. And only just got there in time and they were banging on the car windows and off we went to the airport.
So you think like the previous year, that was exactly the reason why they'd stopped touring and now he's got that again.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you mean they had stopped touring? Yeah, but I think if they'd come in March when I was there, I think it would have been very different. And that's why I felt bad because I thought, oh God, you know, I've kind of led them astray. But actually, it was really cool.
Yeah. So you came back to the UK with them, is that right?
Yes, I did. So I'd left all my stuff behind. I just happened to have my passport on me. So
that very day?
Yeah. And wow. I think I seem to remember we went via where I was staying with Judy Wong. And I think I'd got like a couple of things. But I thought maybe we were going to LA or we were going to, because George had been recording in LA. But we actually flew to LA and then straight back home.
So where did you stay?
Oh, I stayed with Patty and George.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't have anywhere to stay. And, you know, they had their house in Surrey. And it was from there we were told that Maharishi had come to London and that he was actually going to be speaking at one of the hotels in Hyde Park, Park Lane. And so, we all went together. Then after that, we all went to Bangor in Wales a few days later to get initiated.
Yeah. Because it must have been for you, you're looking for something. You weren't quite sure what it was. Mm. And I suppose after the disappointment of how Haight Ashbury turned out, this must have been a, wow, this could be a new thing. Or were you slightly cynical? Or?
No, I think that's right. And, you know, because Maharishi had said, you know, if they all went to India and got learned how to actually be people, you know, that they could initiate other people, that they would set up a place in England, in London, a sort of Maharishi place. And so I was really excited about that because I wanted something that felt it had some meaning, but also something that was more spiritual than, say, modelling.
Yeah. Going back to Bangor, obviously, this is where the Beatles and yourselves found out about Brian Epstein. What was that like? It must have been awful.
Oh, that was so sad. He was so sad, but also I think what was sad is that Maharishi kept saying, no, Brian wouldn't want you to be sad. You know, sort of get a grip kind of thing. Yeah. And so they were trying to, and I remember listening to them talking to the press, just trying to really be up about it, and Maharishi says this or that. So I don't think they really got a chance to grieve.
No.
I think probably everybody was in shock.
Meanwhile, back in London, when the Beatles open a shop in Baker Street, everything slows down. A rolling stone's throw from Orchard Street, it's The Apple, the Beatles' new boutique. To mark the opening, the proud owners gave an apple juice party. John Lennon and George Harrison were the hosts. The other two Beatles were out of town. Paul's in Liverpool and Ringo's in Rome. Disc jockey Alan Freeman talking to Cilla Black. A later arrival, Richard Lester, director of the Beatles films, among a whole host of the in crowd.
Well, they seemed to dive into their work, didn't they? Then they started doing, well, Apple and the Apple Boutique and Magical Mystery
Tour. That's right.
You worked at the Apple Boutique.
Yes, because on our way back, I drove back with Patty and George, and they let me out in London because I was staying with a friend. And then George kind of hopped out of the car, and they'd obviously been chatting, he and Patty, and said, would you like to come to India with us? I couldn't believe it. You know, it was just like a dream come true. And so I just said, how can I repay you? And he said, just be yourself. And that was the thing about the book, you know, that was the journey to just being yourself was what the book's all about.
Mm. Again, when you were, before you went to India, the boutique, I mean, you were working with Pete Shotton as well, weren't you? So it seems.
Yes, I think he and I were the managers. And that was fun because I knew other people who were working there. They're old friends. And it was fun telling people about, you know, this different world and a world of colour. It's not black and white. And, you know, all the clothes are very colourful. And it was like being back in San Francisco. You know, it was all, they had all the sort of pop paraphernalia and, you know, pipes and everything. And then downstairs, they had more clothes. And that's where Donovan came down the steps one day. And he didn't know, you know, he said, oh, I didn't realise you were working here. And I'd met him before at Patty and George's. And so he wanted to know all about San Francisco and all about Maharishi. And so we sort of set up, you know, a bit more of a friendship. And there was one point where he said, you know, I'd like you to come for lunch at my manager's. So I went over one Sunday and he said he'd got a song that he'd written for me and he'd like to play it. So we went off into one of the rooms and he started singing Jennifer Juniper. And it was so, I was pretty shy. And so I realized, gosh, you know, he really feels something for me, or this is more than just a friend. But it was lovely. I just thought it was the most beautiful song I'd ever heard.
Tell me about that, because as you say, you were friends and he's effectively declaring his love for you. Is it? I think you were saying, when it goes into French, you kind of, oh, that's a bit of a relief. I don't have to face it.
Yeah, yes. It was sort of, I was quite sort of like surprised, but bowled over.
Yeah. There's a lovely bit in your book when you said, because I always wondered the line, is she breathing? Yes, very low. But that was about you meditating.
I think it probably was. I never asked him, but I'm sure that's what it was.
And this time you were at Magic Alex's place?
Yeah, I was renting a room there. I had been when I was working at the Apple Boutique, I was renting a room in the block of flats where Mick lived. So although we weren't going out together then, we'd broken up, we were still great friends. And there were a whole bunch of other boys living there. So I lived there. And then I think for some reason, I can't remember why, but I knew I was going to be going to India fairly soon. So I just rented a place at Alex's little townhouse.
Again, it seems from your book that both Donovan and Magic Alex were sort of vying for your attention. I mean, we'll come back to him later, but what do you recall about Magic Alex at this particular time?
Well, I think he was very possessive. And I think that was the same with his friendship with John, because the night before we were going to India, John and Cynthia came over and Alex was still trying to dissuade him from going to India, you know, to see his guru instead. And so he was like that with Donovan. It was because Donovan was my friend. It was almost no, I want you to be my friend. You know, it was very childish in a way.
Yeah.
Far from the noise and pace of city life, in the cool, clear air of Rishikesh, North India, Pathy News reports from the meditation retreat of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the man who, through transcendental meditation, is currently bringing peace of mind to the Beatles. Flower-loving Yogi told reporters that his brand of peace of mind could only be truly appreciated by intelligent men of the world with rewarding activities and high incomes. Among his most valued disciples were the Beatles, top of the pop pupils. He did his best to keep them away from outsiders, but George had a way for us.
In your book, I absolutely love your description of India because it's so evocative and so vivid as well. Do you think part of the transcendental meditation, why your memories are so vivid, are due to that?
I think so. I could have stayed there forever. I mean, I didn't really want to leave. It was incredible because everything that I'd been looking for in San Francisco and was trying to get to, either it was taking acid or smoking pot, there you had it, you know. It's like by meditating and just having the Himalayas right there was so inspiring every day. Wow. And what was so much fun, and so our little bungalow bit that had, you know, different rooms, we would sit on the roof during the morning sun, you know, with the morning sun coming on you, and it was just lovely. And then George and Paul and John would have their guitars, and Patty and Cynthia and I would sort of sit up there, and either there was a woman doing henna on our hands, and we were just kind of listening to them and then sort of quietly chatting, and it was just so mellow and lovely. And I noticed that anything that, say, John came up there one day and just said, oh, you know, I couldn't sleep last night, then that becomes a song. You know, it was extraordinary. In every song, there was something to do with what was going on, whether it was Bungalow Bill or Dear Prudence, or, you know, it was everything that was going on in the ashram.
Yes. You mentioned that the Maharishi, you thought he might have suspected that you're a bit sceptical.
Yes, because the thing is, I was never ready for any kind of guru, because I'd had my own sort of what I called a sort of awakening. I wasn't looking for anybody to tell me what to do. But although I did the meditation and I got a lot out of the meditation, for me, that was enough. And so I always was a little bit squirmish, because I always thought, well, if he has these powers, he can see that I'm not really that into him.
Right.
But I love the meditation.
Yeah. I think because you got sick, didn't you, while you were there?
Yeah. I got sick, and I went in the middle of the night, sort of sweating and just feeling terrible and dizzy. But in the middle of the night, I went to find where Maharishi's little place was, you know, because the ashram was quite big. And so I woke him up. One of his guys opened the door, and I said, you know, I'm feeling really bad. And he said, oh, you're just going through, what did they call it? I don't remember what they called it.
The iceberg?
An iceberg. And he said, you know, if you've meditated a long time, which is I was doing a 1 or 2, 3 day meditation, all the past stuff that you've never released before starts to become released. And so he said, go back and just keep meditating. So I went back and obviously had a really high fever, sat on the floor and tried meditating.
Oh, no.
And then when Patty came in the next morning, she saw me lying on the bed. She said, oh, my God, you look terrible. And a doctor was called for. We were miles from anywhere. So this doctor arrived and said, oh, yeah, it's tonsillitis.
Right.
That was fine. I lay there and feeling terrible. Didn't want to eat anything. And then another doctor came later in the day. And, of course, it was dysentery.
Oh, no.
And no wonder, you know, it's like, oh, I had visitors who'd come and see how I was. And one of the visitors was John and Cynthia. And John had done a drawing for me. And the drawing was of this sort of guru type of person with a pipe, the flute. And he was sitting cross-legged. And there was this cobra sort of coming out of a basket. And underneath he put, "By the power that's in and the power that's out, I cast your tonsil lighthouse out. Love, John and Sin."
Yeah. And at this point, we don't know where that is, do we, sadly?
We don't, because my mother was looking after it for me. I don't know, you know, often because she had her young sons there too, and, you know, our brothers, and they'd had their friends would come in. And I know each of the Beatles gave her albums and they all signed them, and, you know, to Mummy. And they were all missing because these kids would come and probably just help themselves.
So if anybody out there knows, please let us know.
Yes. Please.
But you were saying about the Maharishi wasn't keen if you took days or if you went wandering down to the Ganges and things like that.
No, but we didn't take any notice of that. No, it was great. It was lovely because we got to know there were the young ones and then there were the older ones. And the older ones in the ashram were all a bit sort of sniffy about us. You know, we were the sort of rebels in a way. And we'd go down to the Ganges. Patty and I once went across the Ganges into the village of Rishikesh. And that was great fun. And I think there was one point where we were walking along this very narrow passageway, and this woman, there was a school, little children in a classroom. And so the teacher saw us, and so she asked us to come into the class. And so there we were, and the little kids were laughing. They'd obviously never seen anybody from the West before. But it was just the most extraordinary experience. I think we were there just under 3 months, maybe two and a half months.
I think George was obviously getting really into it. You were saying you haven't seen all of Get Back yet, but there's a point where he mentions he was a bit disappointed when people took days off or went travelling.
That's right. Yeah, because I remember Donovan, when he arrived, we'd go down to the Ganges together and he'd play his guitar. And he asked me if I'd like to come to the Taj Mahal with him. But I felt the same way. I didn't want to go anywhere. You know, I felt we were in paradise.
You said about composing songs. I mean, I'm So Tired, you've mentioned, obviously, Dear Prudence, about Prudence Farrow. But it's such a lovely, beautiful, airy song. But you were saying it's, you know, she had it pretty bad at the time.
Yes, yes, yes. She just, she was over by our bungalows, and all she could do was sit up in bed, and she was in a zone, you know, just nobody could get her out of this, I don't know, mesmerized or something. And I went in with my flute and started playing something, making some sort of noise. And then John went in with his guitar and started singing Dear Prudence. And the creativity was extraordinary, you know, for everything. It's like John doing his drawing. If he wasn't playing, then he'd be drawing. Or, you know, it was just so abundant.
And you said you were writing poems yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd get a chair and sit right by the Ganges and wrote poems.
It sounds like bliss.
It was bliss. It really was bliss. Yeah.
And a few days ago, I contacted you about some notes Mal Evans took, which are in the Beatles book from 1968.
Yes.
I thought it might be fun if I just read a few bits out and see how it compare your memories.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts, right, this is Mal. "For me, the trip began early. On Wednesday, February the 14th, I picked up bundles of advanced luggage from Weybridge and Esher. Suitcases, guitars and trunks belonging to George and Patty, her sister Jenny and John and Sin. Then I caught Qantas flight 754 for Delhi, leaving London at 3:30 in the afternoon. The idea was for me to arrive a day ahead so that I could organise transport at the other end from Delhi to Rishikesh. At London Airport I had to pay £195.19.6 in excess baggage charges. So you can tell how much stuff I was taking out on behalf of the Lennons and Harrisons."
That's so sweet.
Yeah. It seems like nothing was ever too much for Mal.
No.
What are your memories of Mal?
A big teddy bear. He was. He was lovely. He was such a sweet, lovely person.
Yeah, he was saying that because he had trouble sitting down cross-legged, so he had to have his own chair. So, and then he moves on to, at 8:15 a.m. on Friday morning, George, John, Patty, Sin and Jenny flew in. There to meet them and say hello was Mia Farrow. I had already introduced myself to her back at the hotel and found out that her brother Johnny was due to fly in about the same time as the two Beatles.
Yeah.
Any memories of that?
Yes. I remember, I don't remember meeting Mia Farrow there. I'm not sure if we did, but I do remember the drive from the airport to Rishikesh. And there was one point, you know, Patty, George and I were in this one of those ambassador cars. And at one point we had a stop just to stretch our legs. And I had this incredible feeling that I'd been here before.
Really?
It was very, very pronounced. I remember telling George that. And I think he had that feeling too, because, of course, he and Patty had been to Kashmir to be with Ravi. So they, you know, they'd been to India before. But it was, I was just, already I was in heaven.
And it was 150 miles from Delhi to Rishikesh. So it's a fair old drive.
Yes, yes. And it's funny because I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, that we stayed the night in Delhi. And I knew we didn't, because I can remember us getting in the cars and driving straight there.
Mm.
I'm glad Mal says that too.
There's another bit here. Our days at Maharishi's ashram began early. As a rule, John was first out of bed. That actually surprised me, but anyway. He'd spend a while meditating, and I would accompany him to breakfast around 7 o'clock. We would leave the little row of cottages, walk down towards the Ganges, past the lecture hall, and towards one of two dining halls. We went past the kitchens on the edge of the Ganges, and if it wasn't too chilly, we'd usually eat in the uncovered dining hall. No roof, just huge glass walls.
Yes. Well, I would get up. Well, just going back to when I did that 2-3 day meditation, I remember coming out of a meditation, and if I saw anybody, I wouldn't be able to speak because I felt so sort of high just on meditating. But what I would normally do, get up, probably get up early, do my meditation, and then walk down to the breakfast place. I only remember the breakfast place where we sat outside, overlooking the Ganges.
All right.
Because then you'd see monkeys afterwards, you know, clambering on the tables after we'd eaten. But I think there must have been some kind of, what did he say, a glass wall or something?
Yeah, he goes on a bit. He says, yeah, we'd usually in uncovered dining hall, no
uncovered
roof.
Uncovered dining hall,
just
yes.
Huge glass walls.
Yeah, and that was near the kitchen. There's a funny little kitchen where we'd usually have rice and dal or tea with carnation milk in it.
Oh, carnation milk, I remember that. He always mentions about the marmalade and so on, and saying how it sort of resembled the UK ones, but sort of printed in India. It's all sort of local produce.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he goes on, actually talking about breakfast. Breakfast would start with cornflakes, puffed wheat or porridge. The porridge was to be avoided because it tended to be a bit lumpy. To drink, there was fruit juice, tea and coffee. Yeah, after breakfast, we'd meditate for as long as we wanted. There were no hard and fast rules. Everything was free and easy. No schedule or timetable to be stuck to. Anyone who just wanted to sleep around the clock could do so. But it sounds very free and easy. I thought there'd be more.
Very free and easy, yeah. I remember at the beginning we had sort of assembly in the evenings. And there was somebody who contacted me years ago because of a book I'd written. So obviously they saw I had a website. And he had been in India at that same time. And I remember him. There's photographs. In fact, there's a photograph in the book of him and me sitting by the Ganges.
Oh, yes.
And Richard. And he wrote a book. And his memory is great, actually, because it sort of enlarged what my memory was. And he said that George used to come down and sort of play his sitar amongst a lot of the younger ones, too, not just up on our roof.
Lovely.
Yeah.
He goes on, when Ringo arrived later, because Ringo and Paul arrived after you, didn't they? So
yes.
he found some of the curry dishes a bit too hot with too many spices. So when I went to Delhi again, I collected a good supply of eggs so that we could have plenty of alternatives. Fried eggs, boiled eggs, or poached eggs.
And it wasn't the tins of baked beans.
That's right, yeah, he took those, he bought them himself. Do you remember when, because you must have been there for a bit before Paul and Ringo and their girlfriends and wives arrived. Do you remember the feeling of, was it a lot of, hey, welcome, we're having the time of our lives? Or?
No, I don't remember the exact when they arrived. But I remember when we were sitting around the breakfast table or lunch table, you know, that they were there. Yeah.
He goes on. And this is about the lectures, which you were saying. So the Maharishi never appeared at meals to eat with his students. He stayed in his own bungalow at these times. We were there 3 weeks behind the rest of the meditators. So he used to give us extra lessons, extra lectures in the afternoons. I'm guessing when you were saying some of the older people, the fact that you arrived 3 weeks after they've been doing it, there must have been a bit of snobbery.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And then apparently the friend who wrote his book, he remembers us all coming into the lecture room that evening. And a friend of his sort of happened to turn around and all he said was, holy shit, take a look at this. And they thought we were like wanderers, you know. And then suddenly they realised that it was Paul and John. And seats had been reserved for them and, you know, for us. And, must have been such a shock.
Yeah. We'd all sit in the open air, sometimes on chairs, on the grass, and sometimes on the flat sunroof. When it was cooler, we'd join him in his bungalow, sitting around on cushions. That's when he said he got his own chair.
Yes. Oh, I do remember sitting outside, because I always sat so I could just face the Himalayas, you know, and just... And he'd say things, laugh about gold, have once a gold aeroplane, or he had one. And I remember thinking, ooh, no. That's not what you're meant to be longing for. So, I remember we did see a lot of Maharishi.
Yeah.
To begin with.
Mal kind of explaining the meaning behind it. He said, people would recount their meditation experiences, and Maharishi would explain the causes of the sensations and thoughts we'd had. The idea was to build up to longer meditation periods, gradually tapering off again towards the end of the course, so that everyone could come out of Rishikesh more or less feeling down to earth again.
Yeah, I do remember there were some people... See, that's what happened with Prudence. That's why she flipped out, because she just carried on meditating and didn't stop. And then there was talk, but I don't know, who knows, that she'd taken too much acid beforehand, or, you know, it was all just a bit too extreme. But I do know that she was fine, you know, that when she, by the time she left, you know, although we weren't there right at the end, but that she, you know, she was fine.
Yeah.
But there's usually people saying things like their electricity had gone, or, you know, I remember there was a psychic woman down further down the track. And I think I had something on my leg, and I remember her coming over and sort of doing some psychic stuff on my leg. There were all these different kind of characters.
Yeah, he mentions that actually. Oh, and you got the birthdays. There were three birthday celebrations. Just before George's birthday, I went off into Rishikesh Town Centre to do a bit of shopping. I remember using this fantastic horse-drawn taxi to take me through the narrow streets. All the local children seemed to think I was an amazing sight. Which, what you were saying before, imagine, what was he, six foot five? They trooped after me in great crowds wherever I went. I arranged a special cake for George with white icing and pink flowers and an Indian greeting, Jaguru Deva, written along the top in gold letters. Then I put a bundle of fireworks and some streamers, balloons and so forth. Earlier on, I had bought an Indian banjo as my own gift to George. Patty's birthday was just as much of a fun occasion. Everyone was only too willing to join in a bit of a party. Patty had another huge cake. They were all a bit like peas pudding, but tasted great, with 9 or 10 candles. Again, there were dozens of beautiful garlands of red and orange flowers for everybody. And Patty played a new Dilruba, is that how you pronounce it?
Dilruba.
Her favourite instrument these days.
Yes. And I think Donovan was there at that time. And I think also she shared her birthday with, what's his name? from the Beach Boys.
Mike Love.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a recording of that as well, of them singing a song. There? Happy birthday, Mike.
Yeah. Love. Happy
Yeah, that must have been amazing, having a birthday party in the Himalayas.
Yeah, right. I mean, incredible. And have you seen that school photograph? It looks like a school photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got that hanging up here.
And everybody looks so peaceful.
Yes.
Yeah, and then he's going, everything was so relaxed, informal, casual and friendly. Everybody made new pals easily. After the first couple of weeks, the long flat roof above the main lecture hall was used as a sun balcony where we'd all gather for unrehearsed music sessions after our day's meditation periods were over. The Beatles had their guitars, George used his sitar, is what you're saying, and folk like Mike Love of the Beach Boys and Donovan would join in. In no time, the fellows were singing away together and new tunes were being made up all the time. So you're basically watching them make the White Album.
Yes, yes, yes. And there was a lovely moment too when we were allowed to go down to the Ganges and we went with Maharishi. I think there's a little video of it on YouTube. And we're all, you know, traipsing down to the Ganges. Donovan's there too. And then George and Paul and John have all got their guitars and then they're singing and playing their guitars as we're all sitting around on the Ganges. I mean, just lovely.
Again, what you were saying about that, you know, Prudence and her meditating, he says, John and George were meditating for anything up to 8 or 9 hours each day. The record for the course, I don't think this is John and George, was a non-stop 42 hours, which is unbelievable.
Oh, God.
Then as the course drew towards its end, the idea was to decrease the length of time. The last to leave Rishikesh at Easter were John and George. They were invited to spend an extra fortnight with Maharishi in a houseboat, but they declined because George had agreed to appear in a semi-documentary film in Madras with his friend Ravi Shankar. John and Sin were ready to get back home after 8 weeks to see what was happening in Britain. But I think that's not...
I don't understand that because I don't think that's true.
No.
Because that, I remember George waking me up one morning saying, come on, Jenny, we're going. And so we all had to traipse past Maharishi because he'd been alerted, you know, his prize troop were leaving. And we walked past him. And then Patty, George and I all went to Madras and to meet up with Ravi. Ravi was on the road on tour. And so we toured around with him for a while.
Yeah.
I think for about a couple of weeks.
I think that's because this appeared in the Beatles Monthly magazine. So I don't think Mal was going to share the actual reason, perhaps.
No.
I mean, we mentioned him before, because Magic Alex had actually arrived at this time.
Yeah.
Did things change?
To make trouble, I always thought. Yeah, yes. Isn't it funny when you look back on how things kind of went? And in a way, it was a shame. And I remember we were in a hotel in Delhi when everybody was kind of going to be making their separate ways. And I remember them trying to decide, do we tell the press? Do we say, this is, you know, because they were the ones that said, we're all meditating now. And Maharishi's, you know, told us this and told us that. And, you know, did they have a responsibility to their followers in a way?
Yeah. Well, they've been telling everybody how wonderful it was. And,
yeah,
you know, from your experience, did the Maharishi, did you see anything or hear anything?
No, I didn't. I didn't, and because I think I was just so into loving it all and doing my meditation. And, you know, I remember wandering along with Cynthia sometimes, or I think I was doing a lot of the meditation.
It's like anywhere, there's always politics going on somewhere behind.
Yes.
While you're having fun.
Exactly.
And, yeah, you mentioned Cynthia because you went to Greece with her.
Yeah. Went to Greece with her and Magic Alex and Donovan. And then when we came back, obviously, because I still got my room at Alex's, there was Alex, me and Cynthia when we took her back. And, of course, we got into the house and there was John and Yoko. And I can't remember. I don't remember Yoko leaving or anything like that, because then we went into the kitchen. She obviously must have just slipped out. And that's when John was just sort of lying on this, like a chaise long, with his feet right at the end. And I was standing by the door and sort of at the end there. And he's just wiggling his toes and just saying, "Hello, Jenny." You know, like a naughty little boy. Yeah, Mummy was home now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Cynthia in her book describes, it must be awful. And she said she just tried to carry on as if nothing was, it must have been so awkward.
Awful, yeah. Because obviously, you know, things weren't quite right, but quite a shock for her, poor thing.
From just books and whatnot, you do read that in India, I don't think Cynthia really saw much of John, because of the meditation. But I'm guessing that was also the same for most people, wasn't it? I think if you're spending much time.
I would have thought so. Yeah. See, that's why it would be quite fun just to go and walk off, you know, get a few of the other young ones and just walk to the Ganges and chat. And I remember one story, actually, I've got it in my book, where we were sort of a little group of us were sitting right by the Ganges. And these two very, very white guys came towards us looking really sickly and pale. And they said, you know, "Hi, we're staying in the cave not too far away, and we got some great acid. Would you like some?" And all of us were trying really hard not to laugh, and said, no, that we're fine. And so off they went, and they had their little kind of, you know, whatever they call them, where it looked like their nappies, you know.
Well, I mean, that must have been strong stuff.
Oh, God.
So moving after, obviously, they started recording the White Album, and during the sessions, Jeff Emerick noted, and a few people did, that the relationship between John and Paul was a bit different than it was before they went to India. Did you notice anything at all?
No. See, remember, you know, I was only, 19, and I was quite shy. You know, I'd sort of see whoever was at the table, breakfast or lunch or whatever. But no, because, you know, I'd see them playing their guitars together. And
yeah. When you say you're shy, is that how you felt at the time? When you look back, to me it sounds like you couldn't have been that shy, because you are... So you're surrounded by the Beatles, you're living this beautiful psychedelic world. Maybe you weren't that
shy. But maybe I wasn't, because here's another instance, is that when we got back, and I think Yellow Submarine, was that the one that came out sort of? Yeah, and we all went to the premiere, and I was sitting next to Paul. I don't know quite where Patty was, but they were somewhere in there. And I remember him saying something, and maybe he was just trying to make conversation, and we'd just come back from India, said something like, "I know I've known you in another life," or something like that. And so I can't remember anything else. I can't really remember chatting. And I was doing a Zoom. It was during COVID, because I was meant to have gone to the Beatle Fest in New Jersey. And I remember telling that story, and then the guy wrote back, because, you know, the audience can, or they can all communicate with you.
Yeah.
They said no, because I actually happened to be sitting about 3 or 4 rows back. I could see you two talking nonstop. So maybe I wasn't as shy as I thought I was, you know.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
I think so, because I kept reading your book, and I think, well, I was very shy as a youngster. I couldn't have done any of that. I wouldn't have had the bottle.
Yeah.
I mean, people just go and get this book. It's so good. I mean, it's been out a while, but this is the paperback version. And it's not just about the Beatles. It's a great insight, especially like LA in the 70s. And
yeah.
The one thing that has really moved me as well is your relationship with your father and how that sort of moved your life forward in many ways.
Yes. And in fact, you know, while I was writing it, because I was saying it took quite a number of years, is that it was during that time that I actually found him. And when I did first see him, it was really horrible. And then after a while, you know, I wrote to him and said, "Unless you tell me who you are, I'm not going to see you again." And I think the fact that he had to write that out, what happened and the terrible accident during the war and all this stuff, it opened something. It thawed this sort of thing inside him that I think had been there ever since. And he was never had been able to talk about it. And he was very closed off. And so, you know, I saw him probably like the day before he died. I went to the hospital, and I know he just for a second recognized me again. And then he said, you know, "What are those white rabbits doing over there?" And, you know, he'd kind of gone into another world. But it was my journey, my search to find this father.
And you're in your mid-30s and you think, oh no, I'll just take a master's degree in counselling psychology. Like you do.
No, I think that happened because we were on, I was married to Ian Wallace, drummer Ian Wallace at that time. And we'd recently got married, or we had decided to go on a honeymoon a year or so later. And then Bonnie Raitt and her boyfriend, Rob, came to join us. And he had some like magic mushroom, but sort of synthetic, which is always stronger. And so we took it. I hadn't had anything like that for years, since the 60s. And so then we decided to all go and swim, and I'm not a strong swimmer. They went out, and I sort of, for some reason, only took my goggles and didn't take my snorkel. And I was out quite far. They were out really far. And suddenly I just got mesmerized by all the coral down below.
Oh,
and
no.
And I didn't want to put my head up anymore. You know, I just sort of thought I could breathe underwater. And when I took a great big breath in, you know, it was just like came up struggling and there were big waves. So I literally thought that was it.
Yeah.
But managed to get back to the shore. But it was after that, I remember thinking, you know, it's time to give back. And that's when I joined a 3-month course to talk to young kids in schools about drugs and alcohol. And then from there, I wanted to go further. And that it changed my life.
And you've got a therapy for addiction in Tucson, Arizona.
Then I you had to have a master's. So that was good. At least I had that because I was looking, you know, I wanted to have a job once I'd, you know, completed. And so I was meant to be doing their marketing. I'd never done any marketing. I didn't have a clue. But the thing is, that was how I got back to England, because I you know, became more confident, and I'd get people to go to Cottonwood, which is the treatment center, another treatment center in Tucson from here. And a lot of people did. So I'd see them when they came back. I'd do the aftercare group, and I'd also see them beforehand. And pretty much every night when I came back from the aftercare group, I was in tears because it was so moving. You know, they had found they'd got another chance. You know, they could have died. And as the sense of gratitude was, you know, was so powerful.
My generation and younger, there's such a love at the moment for 1960s, everything about it, all the culture, the music, the films, the books, the writing, everything. But obviously with that is the drugs as well. But you forget there's going to be a fallout at some point.
Mm.
And you've kind of pushed part of your life to help others with that.
Yeah, because, you know, we've seen, you know, like Peter Green, who kind of began Fleetwood Mac. It was so sad seeing, you know, someone who was such a genius and played guitar so beautifully, wonderful songwriter, and the agony that he was going through. Yeah.
You forget because obviously you're with Mick and you're with people like Peter Green and you're seeing all these people at the time. Well, Jenny, thank you so much. As I say, I would recommend anybody getting this book. It's not just about the Beatles, but if you're into the 60s and 70s, let's face it, everybody is. It's just a fascinating insight. And I guess overall, I mean, what are your treasured memories?
I would say definitely India. India, wonderful. But also the fun of going to clubs and dancing, and you know that the joy that gave was lovely, and just feeling part of your tribe in a way.
Jenny Boyd, thank you so much.
Lovely, thank you, Chris. Good to talk to you.